Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Bob Abele. Bob has been on many times before. He's a professor of philosophy at Diablo Valley College in California. We've got lots to talk about during the hour. I told Bob ahead of the program, I just briefly, and Bob can jump in on this too, briefly I wanted to mention what I've been following for the past few days. I follow so much, but when something that should make headlines, proper headlines, jumps up at me, I certainly want to cover that. And on the 7th and 8th, and on the 9th as well, scheduled for the 7th and 8th, went over to the 9th, finished after midnight last night, Saturday night. So-called Iran and nuclear talks were ongoing in Geneva, Switzerland. Well, we've seen multiple previous rounds. This has gone on for years. I expected little or nothing this time. I certainly expected nothing of enough substance for ordinary Iranians and for the government and for the economy to come out of these talks. Details have been kept under wraps. The only thing we know are some bits and pieces that have been leaked. But from what I made of it, and I wrote enough about it, it really was offering a very little to Iran in return for major concessions. And it sounded like, to me, even though the Iranian officials put a brave face on what was going on, I can imagine what they must have felt privately and as they discussed things between themselves, hopefully in rooms that weren't bugged. I'm sure they were. isn't that the way the empire does business? I'm sure they were not too pleased with what was offered them. I mean, basically, America is the lead belligerent. Behind the scenes, Israel is. So-called P5-1 countries, the five permanent members of the Security Council plus Germany, that's what P5 plus one is. Israel was not present, but its agenda absolutely was front and center. It always is with anything relating to the region, especially when it comes to Iran. And Netanyahu went absolutely ballistic. I have another article, and it's coming tomorrow. While the talks were ongoing, he called the appropriate heads of state of Germany, France, Obama, of course, and Great Britain, and basically said he wants none of this thing. He wants them to reject any kind of deal coming out. He called any deal a bad deal. Well, from what I know, and I may be wrong again because they don't have the official details, but from what I can make of things, I call the deal a bad deal for Iran. I call it a good deal for the empire. But the deal went down in flames after midnight last night. Temporarily, there'll be another round of talks on the 20th of November. They could go beyond on the 20th. This one got a little bit serious for a while because the last day, the secretaries of state of at least five of the countries came in. Britain, France, John Kerry came. Russia's Sergei Lavrov, a Russian vice premier of something or other, probably China's foreign secretary, and the names are very hard to pronounce. I don't have it in front of me, but he showed up on Saturday. I think he came late Saturday. Everybody got involved in the discussions. There were group discussions. There were bilateral discussions. You can imagine the stuff that went on, and Russia and China absolutely want a legitimate solution, and yet they're outnumbered by the others, and mainly Washington. Washington has exerted 34 years of hostility against Iran. You expect that to go away in 2 days in Geneva, or 5 days, or 2 months? It's not going away in a hurry. And the key thing I want to say is this, Bob, and then you can jump in. Iran's nuclear program is absolutely legitimate. Everybody knows about it. U.S. intelligence annually puts out a report on Iran. It says there is no evidence whatever that it has a military component. Everybody who needs to know knows this, and yet they pretend otherwise, like Iran is developing nuclear weapons or plans to do it. In other words, it's a big lie. The issue is not Iran's nuclear program. That's a red herring. The issue is sovereign Iranian independence. Washington tolerates no sovereign independent states. Why else did it go to war against Afghanistan, against Iraq, against Libya, against Syria right now, a proxy war? These were all independent sovereign countries, ones that America did not control. They wanted control. If they couldn't get it any other way, they went to war to get it. They target Iran. There have been long-standing war plans ready to be implemented any time against Iran. Israel has the same ones. You think Israel won't attack? It won't do it by itself. Iran is no pushover, but it's attacked Syria at least five times this year on single days, targeting individual sites. The reasons given were absolutely phony. Syria didn't retaliate, because it knows the consequences. Israel would hit much harder. America would get involved directly. There'd be a full-scale intervention, full-scale war. That's the last thing Syria wants. Bob, I'll stop here, but again, I'll just repeat. I expected little and nothing from these talks. I expect nothing on the 20th of November.
Well, the fix is in, Stephen. I mean, even in your article, you talked about who the major players are in the background for as far as Washington is concerned, the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs and the American Enterprise Institute. If there were any two right-wing radical organizations that should not have that kind of, I'll call it, hegemonic influence in Washington, I would pick those two as organizations that shouldn't, and yet they do. But the interesting thing to note, I think, in regard to what you were saying is that, unlike Iran, Israel has never signed a nuclear nonproliferation treaty. Iran has, and it's abiding by that treaty. All reports indicate that, from the UN to every other inspection to every other study, they all show that Iran is acting within the nuclear nonproliferation treaty. Unlike Israel, who not only did not sign it, Israel refuses to acknowledge what everybody else in the world knows, and that is that it has nuclear weapons. So there's a double standard that's going on there. And it is further exacerbated, like when you talked about in your article, about what the agreement is likely to require, and that's going to require Iran to halt the uranium enrichment to 20%, less than what it's permitted to do by the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and agree not to use its high-speed centrifuges, also allowed by its signing of that pact. So the United States and Israel don't just want to go after Iran in terms of their abilities to produce a nuclear weapon. They don't even want Iran messing with anything at all that would give them any type of independence, nuclear independence, energy independence, independence geographically, none of that. And so all of these reasons are concocted to keep pressure on Iran to do what it is that the United States and Israel want them to do. And in conjunction with that, there's a really dangerous new alliance that's forming. Khan Halanan has an article about this in Counterpunch this past week, I think it was. Now we've got Israel joining up with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation Council. So now you've got all this incredible wealth of the Arab oil kings tied into the Israeli army, and now the Egyptian army is getting involved in this. They're usually very this acrimonious relationship between the three of them, now they're finding themselves allied against Iran and against Syria. So this is a very interesting development that has happened in the last few weeks as well. So then they start stocking up, like Israel holding war games last month. Israel now practicing air-to-air refueling of warplanes, which of course is essential for long-range bombing. And Der Spiegel reporting last week that Israel is now arming its German-supplied Dolphin-class submarines with nuclear-tipped cruise missiles. You got to wonder what's going on there, that it's not just a question of let's try to negotiate in public but make it fail, but then here comes the backup. Israel's getting ready to attack. So whether they do or not, it depends upon how you read the tea leaves, because we don't have the details, but they certainly are getting themselves ready for that.
Oh, they absolutely are, Bob. I don't think Israel would lift a finger without an okay from Washington, but there's no question that Israel and Washington both have long-standing war plans readied to go after Iran. So they literally could be implemented at any time. This would not be the right moment to do it, Bob, because, you know, we're going through this charade of nuclear talks, and there'll be another round, and who knows what will happen after the 20th of November. Maybe there'll be something else after that. So this has to play out. If I had to pick a scenario, I would think something might happen next year, possibly something on the order of this round, the round just completed, the one coming up later in November, maybe whatever else may follow that, and the system will be rigged against Iran to make it impossible to come up with a legitimate deal that really is a win-win for everybody, and Iran will be blamed for it. And that'll be the pretext in some way. Maybe there'll be a staged false flag to go along with it, and Iran will be blamed, and that will be causes Belli to either go to war, become damn close to it. I mean, there are all kinds of things that America can pull, and Israel as well. So this is the kind of scenario I see playing out. I mean, there's been hostility against Iran since 1979, Bob. I just can't imagine that that's going to be erased overnight in a couple of days or whatever, and it certainly hasn't at all. All these rounds of nuclear talks, they've literally gotten nowhere, and Iran absolutely has bargained in good faith.
Well, yeah, and if you hear what Kerry had to say on his way to negotiations, he started bragging about how we've got tough sanctions in place, and Iran knows that if they don't come along to our way of thinking, we'll make them even tougher on them. So they're not going into these negotiations thinking there's going to be an outcome, a good outcome. And I think that you're right about the pick of the year 2014, because I think a lot of that has to do with what happens in Syria. That there's another boiling pot right there. And the Syrian opposition leaders, although I hesitate to call them Syrian opposition leaders because there's like 11 different Islamist and jihadist groups kind of held together simply by being supported by the United States and Saudi Arabia. But anyway, the alleged leader of the group says that their goal is to have Assad out and dethroned before the 2014 elections. So the Obama administration, in response, said nothing to that. So 2014 is a telltale sign year in Syria, and I think given what you've just said about Iran, in Iran as well. So these things are all kind of heading to a closing to a head in 2014. And when Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu went nuts, like you talked about, what did the United States say? Well, the only thing we can say about what he says is that it's premature to say those things right now. But they're not saying that's irresponsible, that's illegal, that's off the table. They're basically admitting that these things are on the table of an attack on Iran, but we just don't want to talk about that right now. So it's something that we really need to keep an eye on, particularly given what you just said about Israeli warplanes striking inside Syria again. Really, that has nothing to do with terrorist transfers of weapons, which is what Israel said. In reality, that is an attempt for Israel to establish air superiority. That's the only reason and the strategic reason they could have for attacking Syria the way they did. And that was, as you said, the fifth attack. And this year, was it this year? I guess it's three this year at least, if not five this year. So Israel is the key in this, and you've pinpointed it nicely. But I think Syria and Iran both go hand in hand with this. And they, at a lot of times at the very beginning of this whole process, as it kind of ratcheted up a couple of months ago, Obama kept mentioning Syria and Iran, Syria and Iran. He was tying them together, saying Iran supplies Syria with these weapons. That kind of dropped off the scale, but they're still together, I think.
Well, the last three independent countries in the Middle East, Syria, Iran, and Lebanon, Hezbollah in Lebanon is part of the Lebanese government. It's not. It doesn't hold a majority, but it holds a significant position. So it's the Hezbollah component, the legitimate Hezbollah opponent elected by Lebanese people, that is targeted for elimination. But they're no pushover. They certainly boxed Israel's ears in 2006 after Israel waged a war of aggression. Hezbollah is stronger now than it was then. But Iran is the key. Iran is a strong country. It certainly can retaliate if it's attacked. It can't defeat Israel necessarily. All Israel is such a small country that if Israel, no matter what Israel might do to Iran, Iran is a huge country geographically. Israel is very tiny. Certainly, Iran has targeted all key Israeli sites, including its nuclear sites, if it wants to attack them. And literally, it could really cause some very, very serious damage and a horrific toll in Israel if Israel dares attacks. Iran, of course, could never prevail against Israel and America, especially together. But it's powerful enough to really cause a terrible, terrible situation in the Middle East. And if that happens, you literally could see a regional war war, and a regional war could spread to a global one. The possibility is very much there, and I've mentioned it before on the program. And, of course, a name for a global war is World War III, and if that happens, well, it's Katie by the door. I mean, I remember quoting Admiral Hyman Rickover, the father of America's nuclear navy, Bob. He testified before Congress about 30 years ago, and he supported nuclear power, but he made some very, very telling statements, including that when nations go to war with each other, as needed, they use every weapon in their arsenal. In other words, if you don't need nuclear weapons, you don't necessarily have to use them. But if you do need them, you will use them. And if a war with Iran ever gets to be a nuclear war, then that literally could end up being curtains, and the possibility is very much there. I think Rickover and others have said over the years, Rickover's gone now, but others have said over the years that sooner or later these nuclear weapons, Hiroshima and Nagasaki weren't the only times these weapons were used. There are other radiological weapons that are used in all of America's wars, depleted uranium weapons, enriched uranium weapons, but, you know, not the kind of bombs we know about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but there are vast portions of Afghanistan, of Iraq, I'm certain Syria as well, irradiated because of U.S. weapons and depleted uranium weapons that are used because they cut through metal like a knife through butter. They can be used with bombs, with missiles, with bullets. You literally can tip a bullet with depleted uranium, so you can shoot it at a very tough structure and it'll go right through it. You can just imagine the radiation that's affecting vast parts of these countries. And I've written about a cancer and a birth defects epidemic that has raged in Iraq for many years. I don't hear much about Afghanistan, but there must be terrible trouble going on there as well.
Well, and Yasser Arafat was poisoned with the radioactive isotope of polonium-210. Now we've got the evidence for that, too.
Oh, absolutely. Israel killed Yasser Arafat. There isn't a shadow of a doubt about it, Bob. Proving it is another matter.
Yeah, well, they know for sure now that Yasser Arafat was poisoned.
Oh, yes.
But I mean, when you put that together and you look at what it would require to get that isotope into Arafat's body, it not only has to be from inside, but it had to come, A, from a government, and B, a government that produces it. Because it's really hard to get a hold of. So there's only about 100 grams a year that get produced, and almost all of it is in Russia. So there's a government that aided and abetted in that somehow. So a lot of fingers are pointing at Israel. But and when you think about Ariel Sharon admitted himself in an interview with Bloomberg that he tried to kill Yasser Arafat on 13 different occasions, and he was really bitter about the fact that they weren't able to do it. So if you've got a former leader saying, yeah, we've been trying for years to get him and we couldn't, and then suddenly he gets poisoned with a radioactive isotope, now you got to start pointing fingers at the people who've been saying, we're trying to kill him, but we can't get there. I mean, that's all circumstantial evidence, but it's pretty strong circumstantial evidence.
Oh, it is. And Arafat himself said that Israel tried to kill him 40 times. But it's been a long time, Bob. I've written about how many times America tried to kill Fidel Castro. I don't think they're trying anymore. He's in his late 80s now, and he's really yielded power to his brother Raul. But the numbers that I remember talking about were, of course, Castro was in power for many, many years, 1959, and he's still around. But the number I used was 500. 500 attempts to kill Fidel Castro. There was one that almost succeeded. Somebody got right close to him, and I forget what it was. I think it was something about a camera that had a weapon inside. When clicking, maybe it was a gun, I guess, clicking would shoot him, and the guy literally got practically nose to nose with Castro, and he chickened out, and he didn't kill him. But Castro could have been killed. But 500 attempts to kill Fidel Castro. You see the way America operates, Bob.
It's actually pretty funny, the camera story. You've got to be CIA. Only the CIA would think of something like that. But I want to add, before we drift too far away from Iran, it's interesting to note what the straw polls at the U.S. Congress have to say about their position on Iran. The Israeli attack on Iran has support in the U.S. Congress, and you have Dick Cheney coming out from under his rock talking about how war with Iran is inevitable, and he's trumpeting up But in the American military itself, when you hear what some of the people who are in charge of the military are saying, they're not so hot about this. I mean, Robert Gates said in public this week that an attack would be catastrophic to do and would haunt generations of people all around the world. And former Joint Chiefs of Staff, Chief of Staff Vice Chair James Cartwright told Congress in testimony that if the U.S. backs Israel as they're attacking Iran, it would have to occupy Iran. It would have to send troops if it really wants a clear victory. And everyone agrees that not only tactically would that be virtually impossible, but it wouldn't have any support whatsoever. Now when you tie that into what Israel's banking on, and you kind of implied this, and I think you're right, that Israel is banking on the fact that if it attacks Iran, the United States will back them. And even Obama said that this week, we've got your back. We don't know what exactly he meant by that, but he did say that. But Israel by itself can't fight Iran. And you had said Iran couldn't fight Israel, and you're right, but Israel doesn't have the military capability by itself to do any more than knock out 3, 4, 5 nuclear sites. It's pretty widely dispersed, and Israel doesn't have the bunker buster bombs that allows it to destroy the very deep bunkers in Iran where their nuclear program is going on. It needs the United States to do it. So there's a lot of calculation that's going on here, but the biggest one is the gamble that Israel is taking, that if they go with this, Obama's going to back them, even though the Congress supports it and the military doesn't. There's going to be a lot of back and forth and a lot of cards played on the table before all this happens.
Again, I don't think Israel would do it by itself, Bob, unless Israel believed or had an understanding with Obama that if it attacked, Obama would support the attack and then join in, so it would become a joint attack. Netanyahu has made a lot of threats against Iran over the years. This is his third term as prime minister. I have no idea how many times he's threatened Iran, but it's been many times. He never once followed through, but what Israel does do, it commits, it wages war by other means, cyber war, targeted assassinations. There have been mysterious explosions in Iran. There have been other things that have gone on, plus an awful lot of saber rattling that goes on all the time. And Israel is extremely, extremely hostile, not just hostile to Iran, but expressing it vocally. I think America is just as hostile, but America is a little bit more diplomatic in the stuff that you hear come out publicly. But Israel pulls no punches. Especially Netanyahu. Not everybody in Israel, not everybody in the government, but Netanyahu is on the far end of the right extreme. And the foreign minister, Avigdor Lieberman, who was just exonerated after committing crimes that should have been put him in prison for decades, he was exonerated. I wrote about it. And a former prime minister, Olmert, was also exonerated on many charges. He's still got one pending that's still going on. He'll probably be exonerated from that as well. I wrote an article I call Whitewashing Crime in Israel. I could have said whitewashing it in high places. And I included one paragraph where I said Palestinian children accused rightfully or wrongfully of stone throwing get arrested. They get isolated. Their parents can't see them. They have no right to counsel. They're terrorized. Some of them are tortured. I mean, just imagine a young kid, 12, 13, 14 years going through this. But can you imagine, even if a kid threw stones for whatever reason, that might, if it were unjustified, it might deserve a spanking, but usually it's very much for a reason when kids do throw stones. But putting them through this, and some of them get imprisoned, and if they're arrested, it doesn't matter whether they did it or not, they'll at least pay a fine, and they'll probably be held for a number of days until their parents finally get a right to see them, and then after the kids are totally traumatized, they'll be released. This is young kids, and you get prime ministers and other high officials that commit terrible civil crimes despite the war crimes and all the rest, and literally nobody lays a glove on them.
Yep, that's true. That gives lie to the whole thing of the United States and other democratic nations standing for human rights. I think back to the ignominious anniversary that we had just 10 days ago of our two-year occupation, attack and occupation of Libya, where the whole idea that they were trying to get across 2 years ago was we need to attack because of human rights. Gaddafi is violating the human rights of his people. We need a humanitarian intervention here. And that's how they got Resolution 1973 pushed through, where the establishing of a no-fly zone, and then the call to take all necessary measures to protect civilians, and that was it. It was, let's go attack. That doesn't happen when the people are really being abused by a country that the United States likes, like you were just talking about. The United States allied with Israel. Israel can do what it wants to the Palestinians, but it's not very political for the United States to say, hey, you can't do that. We just attacked Libya over that. They're not going to attack Israel, so that's okay. They can go ahead and do that.
It's a deplorable situation, Bob. I mean, literally, there's a war raging at all times. It is absolutely astonishing. Nobody can think back to a time when there was peace. People might think there was a time when there was peace, but there literally, in my lifetime, there has never been a time of peace. There has always been either a direct or a proxy war going on. So even the interim between Vietnam and the Gulf War in 1991, there were proxy wars in Africa and Central America, and this stuff gets very, very little reporting. Some of it was reported. The African one's probably the least, and this stuff is going on right now. And few people know about it. The media say virtually nothing about it. And America is the lead belligerent. And literally one country after another is ravaged. The Libya situation was absolutely horrendous. Africa's development stage on a global basis, but Libya was Africa's most developed country, literally most developed country, and Gaddafi, whatever his faults were, gave the Libyan people marvelous benefits, absolutely extraordinary. Americans simply wouldn't believe the things that Libyans got absolutely free from the government's oil revenues. They were used for everybody. They were used to grow the economy. They were used for ordinary people. It was really extraordinary. And that country literally has been decimated and destroyed, and violence rages there every single day of the week. People are dying. People are suffering. All the benefits that were there are gone. And look what's happening to Syria now. Syria, the same thing. And I worry about 2014 as well, Bob, where maybe Syria's got elections coming up in 2014. I think that's why it could be an important year. And you're right. Obama and Israel, and I guess their co-conspirators, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, the other Gulf states, they want Syria's President Bashar Assad eliminated. They forget about international law. They're willing to have elections, but they're not willing to let Syrians vote.
Yeah, there you go. That should say enough right there.
I mean, that basically is what covers it. Where, you know, international law, only the citizens of a country have a right to decide who will lead them, not by Washington rules.
Oh, not at all. I mean, the idea of international law, if the United States was concerned about that at all, we wouldn't be having these reports that have been coming out on how much the United States tortures people when they arrest them in these various battlefields. I mean, there were two reports just this week that came out about the torture and the war crimes committed by the United States. And there's been absolutely no response from the Obama administration or anybody in Congress to these reports that are very damning, including the forcing of U.S. medical professionals to engage the war on terror and suspend their do-no-harm principle that they operate by. And, of course, the Rolling Stone report, which is a fascinating reading about the United States war crimes from their alleged A-team in Afghanistan. If the United States had any concern about international law, those would be off the table to begin with, those practices. But if they were revealed, the end result would be a clear call for an investigation and punishment of those people who were involved in those activities. But what do they do instead? They ignore that, and then John Kerry goes off to the Southeast Asia and starts praising the Malaysian Prime Minister, Najib Razak, who does the same stuff that the United States does. So, in terms of their authoritarian, autocratic-type government. So, you really can't talk about the United States and international law in the same breath without smiling or even laughing.
Oh, indeed so, Bob. The music means we need to take a break. Let's do that, and we'll come right back. welcome back, talking with Bob Everly. Bob, I know we want to discuss the agency that we dearly love, Bob. It's part of America's imperial agenda for sure. It's called the NSA. Can I just make one comment before we get into that? I mean, NSA and what it's doing, tied with the other U.S. intelligence agencies, the empire needs a program like this. It needs to watch everybody. What went on decades ago before technology got to where it is today, I mean, back then it was a shadow of what happens today, where literally anything that anybody does electronically, whether it's over the phone, whether it's online, whether it's all records that are stored electronically, like your medical records, your financial records, NSA can literally penetrate anything they want about us and have all that information. They literally can know as much about us as we do ourselves. And this goes on with or without a warrant. You're supposed to have a warrant to be able to search stuff. But and even when it gets a warrant, there's something called a FISA court that is virtually rubber stamped. It's very rare for the FISA court to deny an NSA request. So this stuff just goes through like automatically. And tomorrow happens to be Veterans Day. That's the other comment I wanted to make. And I wrote an article I called Veterans Day Hypocrisy, where I just ripped the holiday apart. Some people confuse Memorial Day and Veterans Day. Memorial Day commemorates the departed ones, the military personnel who died in combat. And veterans commemorate living and dead veterans, whether they engaged in war or whether they simply were peacetime veterans, like I am in the 1950s. I never saw a war theater, thank heavens, but I'm a veteran. And we've got the commemorations, and Obama will go through the usual rituals. His Saturday radio broadcast was completely duplicitous. He talked about how his expression that he has their back, and he has their back 365 days a year, trying to help them readjust to civilian life and create jobs and the rest of it. And I mean, the truth is exactly the opposite of that. He ignored everything that's most important. I ripped apart portions of what he said, and I talked about the horrific situation that veterans are going through, including a major one that gets virtually no coverage, the fact that suicides among active duty military personnel and veterans are absolutely horrific, where there are many of these suicides on a daily basis, and it's because of the ravages of war, the physical ravages, the emotional ravages, and you hear practically nothing about this in the major media. And yet, if you can imagine, maybe 18, 20, I've seen numbers higher than that, maybe two dozen, maybe 30 deaths on a daily basis. I mean, it's just incredible. Some of this stuff doesn't get reported, so it's hard to know exactly what the numbers are. I mean, somebody dies, and unless they blew their brains out or something or other, you simply might not know. If they poisoned themselves, listen, an autopsy was done, you wouldn't know. And even if it's a cause of death, would you know it was a suicide? Would you, maybe it's written up as a murder? Again, you don't know the exact numbers, but the numbers are great. And I saw material quoted. Absolutely staggering statistics where independent studies, as best as they could determine, were that, not on suicides, but as many or nearly half of the veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan have been either physically or emotionally harmed by their combat experience. Nearly half. And there have been hundreds of thousands of U.S. military personnel involved in these wars. If you can imagine the effects on these people and what affects them, affects their families, their wives, their children. There's a lot of violence at home. These young kids, men, mostly men, some women, many of them simply can't adjust when they get back into civilian life. And the government does pathetically little, if anything, to help them. And Obama had the audacity to say everything that he's doing to support our veterans, another lie that he's told.
I didn't know you were a veteran, but you're a veteran from the days that we cared about our veterans and took care of them when they came back from war, at least
yeah.
Better than they have been. That's
oh,
a very
absolutely.
Different story now.
Between after Korea, Bob, I was in college during Korea, and when I got out in 1956, I was in the Army before Vietnam cranked up in the early 1960s. There was stuff going on in Vietnam. I was nearly sent to South Korea, and my commanding officer didn't want to lose me because I was not because I was doing such a terrific job necessarily, but because I was the only one doing the job that in the company that that he was commanding officer of. And he asked me if I wanted to go to South Korea, and I said, if I have a choice, no.
That's a smart move.
I think it was a good choice. I would have gotten the chance to see Asia, but they would have pumped me with all kinds of vaccines and all kinds of other stuff, and vaccines can cause nothing but trouble. So I'm very glad that I declined the offer to go. I really was thinking about graduate school at that time, Bob, and it wasn't too long after that I took a graduate entrance exam for business school, and I got an early release, which got me out about 4 months early. I would have spent, without that, I would have spent about 10 months in South Korea. With an early release, it would have been 6 months. I don't know why they wanted me to go anyway, but anyway, my command officer, I guess he knew people in high places, so he pulled some strings and got my, I literally got orders. He got them pulled.
Well, that's good for you.
Oh, it was great for me. I was very delighted about it.
But in regard to what you were saying about Obama's lines now, today, and how duplicitous they are, I would think that almost anybody who pays any attention, even if they were a diehard Obama supporter for both of his election runs, certainly by now have got to know that he's just a snake oil salesman in terms of his what he has to say. The best line I heard, I think it summarizes it quite nicely. I've listened to this interview with Ralph Nader here in the San Francisco area about 2 weeks, maybe longer ago, and his line was, has there ever been a bigger con man in the Oval Office than Barack Obama? That about says it all. And you can see it every time he opens his mouth. I actually literally have to turn away from the TV when I hear him because he's such a liar. And I would think that people would know that by now.
It's incredible. His approval rating has been dropping, Bob. The latest poll I saw was 41%, and that really is an all-time low during his time in office. But I agree with you. He is an absolute con man from A to Z. Literally, there is nothing that guy says that can be believed. He has no credibility whatsoever. And you've said it, I've said it, other people I respect have said it, and yet still too many people think that, at least he's not George Bush, or at least he's not a Republican. He is every bit as bad as the worst Republicans, but he disguises it with his clever rhetoric. I think calling him a con man really sums up exactly what he is, and I just like to call him a serial liar.
Oh, that's good. That's good. I'm going to, for the sake of NSA listening, I'm going to backtrack and say he's not a liar. He's just not the best truth teller. that way, I don't get in too much trouble with the NSA, who's no doubt eavesdropping on this too, as you had been talking about. And that's something that we were moving into. That I was listing out some of the things from the Snowden revelations that have happened just in the last 3 weeks, and there's almost too many revelations that have occurred to even talk about. But when you look at what has been rolled out from his revelations, the extent, the sheer numbers of what the NSA is tapping into in terms of emails, email addresses, the messages that go back and forth on Twitter and all that kind of stuff that they have. I just wrote down a couple of numbers because they're just astounding to me. This came out in the Washington Post a couple of weeks ago, that the NSA got 444,743 email address books alone from Yahoo, 105,000 from Hotmail, 82,000 from Facebook, 33,697 from Gmail in the course of a single day, one day. That's what they were able to get in terms of emails. So basically what Snowden's revelations are coming out with more, and they're becoming more and more serious as Snowden reveals these more and more, that the NSA programs, basically their collection is unlimited. And that says something about the legalities immediately, because on a representative day, they get, just from the numbers I've quoted, they get an average of 500,000 inboxes from people. So anything that you get in your inbox, in your email, anything I get, they get. And they just put it away. And now we know, because of Snowden's revelation, that they're storing it in several different places just in case they need to target us later on. So, and then, of course, this week comes the revelation that AT&T is getting paid $10 million a year by the CIA to allow the CIA to tap into their databases and record everything that we're doing through AT&T lines and operation account. So, and I have an AT&T account. So my first thought was, wait a minute, I'm a taxpayer. I'm paying the government to spy on me, and I'm paying double. I'm paying through my taxes, and I'm paying AT&T for my monthly account, and I'm paying them to give the government all the information that I'm supposed to be doing in relative privacy. So there's lots of legal issues here. The Fourth Amendment's the most obvious one, the protections against unreasonable searches and seizures. But there's also U.S. statutes involved that says that they're not permitted to collect certain information and they're not permitted to share that information, Patriot Act notwithstanding. The Washington Post talks about that in an article they had this week about it. They didn't specify the law. I guess that would be for an international law attorney to do. But the telecom operators are governed by these laws, and AT&T is handing over to information to the CIA that is illegal under that law. And so I'm looking to – I actually wrote a letter to Dianne Feinstein, who's my congressperson, and I got a letter back from her. And she said to me in her letter to me something no different than she has said to anybody else. And her she gives her unqualified support of what the NSA is doing. She says they're patriots. She said we have to trust Obama that he knows what he's doing. And then you get the news that comes on the top of that, that there's a new bill that Feinstein is behind that would give extensive powers, more extensive powers to the NSA against Americans and add money to their budget. So Feinstein and Saxby Chambliss, who is a Republican, can't remember what state he's from now, they plan on introducing a bill that would give legislative sanction to the FISA court that you had mentioned. And so when Feinstein was asked in a press conference this week, what about the people who are doing this in violation of the law, she said they just follow the orders they're given. So I don't really see how we're going to make any inroads on this in terms of my own congressperson, when I write her and say, this is, there's all these illegalities, and she writes me back and she says, not as far as I'm concerned, I think they're great patriots. Well, where are we supposed to go with all of that? So in the meantime, all these things come up, and now we know that the NSA is involved with Australia and spying on at least 38 foreign leaders. We know now that the NSA and the CIA are working together for the drone war, so that when Obama claims the right to assassinate, the people he picks to assassinate, he gets information from the NSA spy, and on and on and on it goes. So we now know that school children are being targeted by mass data collection. We also know that the NSA has cameras on store shelves, and they're using cell phones to track people's whereabouts, even in the store. They're now recording how long people stop in front of a particular product and what they're doing with that product, and they're doing this on a time basis. This is in the Huffington Post this week. So we've got all this spying going on. And somebody who is at the very top of the pyramid in terms of the authority to do something, who says, I don't see any problem here.
And the notion that this is being done for national security, Bob, is another one of the big lies. This has nothing whatsoever to do with national security. Keith Alexander, the head of NSA, claims that the surveillance has foiled a good number of terrorist plots in America. There have been zero terrorist plots in America. I didn't see the names of all the ones that he supposedly was referencing, but he mentioned a couple, and I've written about dozens of mostly Muslim men who have been lawlessly targeted, charged with either terrorism or conspiracy to commit it or variations thereof. And I have yet to find literally dozens of these people. I've got articles written on all of them. Occasionally I wrote more than one article on a particular person. I have yet to find a single individual guilty of anything. They were all absolutely innocent. They committed no crimes. They were framed. They literally went through a kangaroo court process. I say that because they were tried in civil courts, but jurors were literally terrorized to convict them on the possibility that they would allow a terrorist to run free in their neighborhood. I mean, you can scare people to say, well, you know, we better not take a chance. We better put these people away because we'll never get this out of our minds, or we may have a terrorist running around loose. Well, again, none of these people were guilty. Keith Alexander propaganda is a liar. Dianne Feinstein is a liar. The issue with spying, it's all about domestically, it's all about control. Overseas, it's plain old-fashioned espionage. You know, you spy on other governments, you spy on businesses, you want to steal government secrets, you want to steal business secrets, you want to give America an edge up politically, economically, militarily. That's what spying is all about. It's got nothing to do with keeping America safe.
It's really about continuing to target and stop anybody that they see as a potential threat to the strategic interests of the American elites. That's really what it comes down to. And I think it has the only people that it's really protecting are those people, and they're very small numbers. As Ruth Bader Ginsburg said, you know, if the Supreme Court passes or agrees that the campaign finance law that they're testing comes out to be constitutional, the 500 people whom these laws protect are going to be the only people that benefit from it. So that actually prompted Scott Shane from the New York Times to write this very extensive article last Monday, I think it was, in the Times, where he goes through and going back to what you just said, Stephen, he talks about all the information that the NSA has collected that now we know some of the details. And he talks about these back-and-forth discussions that they've picked up from cell phones from people in Afghanistan have absolutely nothing to do with security. They just laugh at the conversations that are going on. So they're picking up all the stuff that they can and just listening to whatever they want to. That has nothing to do with any type of security of any sort. It just has to do with control and making sure that people are targeted appropriately. And again, here's a third report that came out last week. The ACLU put a report out saying that the NSA is very targeted now on what they call suspicious activity reports. SARs is how they abbreviate it. And they have a program called eGuardian and a couple of other programs that they look for people who are suspicious to the ruling elites in the United States because of things they say and write and email. And they put that, in other words, they're targeting political dissent. And they put these people on their suspicious activity reports and then start collecting their emails and start watching what they do. It has nothing to do with protection from terrorism. It has nothing to do with anything other than protecting the elites and their particular personal self-interest. And report after report after report demonstrates that. And the ACLU's report called Where's the Suspicion in Government Suspicious Activity Reports? You can get that on their website. That really details it quite nicely. There's nothing going on except control over the people. So they got big jails controlled by corporations, politics controlled by corporations, NSA in bed with corporations like AT&T, controlling citizens to the point that if you get too far out of line, you go to one of the corporate jails. I think it really all kind of webs together in that way.
Oh, it sure does. Well, I am sure I am on their list, not just the NSA, but the FBI and the CIA. I'm sure they monitor everything I do. Well, that's fine. I'm very easy to monitor, Bob, because everything I do is public. I hide nothing. I've got nothing to be ashamed of. I've committed no crimes. But you never know. We know the way these people operate. They can say or do anything they want. They can turn truth on its head and claim anything and get away with it because, you know, their word against yours, against jury intimidation and the rest of it. Or they can simply arrest you, throw you in a military dungeon, leave you there indefinitely detained forever if they want to. That's in the National Defense Authorization Act for at least 2 years. So, I mean, if they want to get rid of you or me, Bob, they can easily do it that way, or they could just come and shoot us.
Well, they could do that, too, and nobody would know, be any the wiser. And look what they're doing with David Miranda right now, Glenn Greenwald's partner. They're calling him a terrorist.
Yep.
They're saying that because he was involved with Greenwald and Greenwald had intelligence that was likely to be against what the British government was doing. If they call that espionage activity that endangered people's lives, and that because that type of information that they had was designed to influence a government to change its political causes or whatever, it falls under the definition of terrorism. But that's back to the Patriot Act. And in my Patriot Act book, which was my first book, I had warned about that this particular clause alone in the Patriot Act is something to be alarmed about, that their very definition of terrorism is exactly what the UK government is now using, that anybody who uses any information to try to get the government to change its policies can be deemed a terrorist. And that's exactly what the UK said this week about David Miranda, and they're doing it with others as well. And then, of course, the reports come out last few weeks, I guess. The Committee to Protect Journalists start talking about how Obama has doubled down now on journalists and insider reporting from his own administration so that he puts people up to lie detector tests. And his insider threat program, which harasses the people who are actually trying to be the whistleblowers. Six government employees so far have been facing federal criminal charges, including Edward Snowden, compared with just three in all previous administrations, if I've got my number right. They've also, the Justice Department has also secretly picked up emails and reporter phone calls and logs. It just goes on and on that Obama has doubled down on prosecuting the people who get information to the people who need to know that information if they're going to have a democratic government. So it's this idea that we're not really a democracy anymore, and we only are run by a group of corporate elites who have their own interest in mind. I'm back to that again. So I'll stop and let you jump in.
Oh, it's really laughable to call America a democracy, Bob. It certainly is not that, and especially now where you've got literally a one-party state with two wings, and when you have a Democrat president that exceeds the worst of a Republican predecessor, you know we're in trouble. And so many things about Obama. I mean, a war on humanity at home and away, a war on whistleblowers at home, a war on journalists who expose truths. I mean, a war on anybody that is considered a threat to the state. What's considered a threat to the state? Somebody who tells the truth, the kind of truth the government wants to keep secret. And that's why I say, Bob, if they want to come after you and me, they can just come and shoot us and claim, you know, somebody broke in or whatever. They could easily get away with that. Or maybe poison us the way Israel did to Arafat. They can eliminate us very easily. But there's no question they keep an eye on anybody who dares to challenge the empire. And it's very scary, Bob, because literally something could happen. There could be another false flag like 9/11. Martial law could be declared. The Constitution could be suspended. I think the chance of that happening ahead is extremely high. Whether it will or not, I don't know, but the chance is dangerously high. And I'd hate to look back and say, by God, I really got that one right. I'd sure like to be wrong on that one.
But I think it would be really great to be wrong on that one, but it's really hard to be wrong or think that you're wrong when these revelations keep coming. And now we know for sure that the NSA is involved not just with the British spy agencies, but also the Australian spy agencies as they do Obama's pivot to Southeast Asia, and they're eavesdropping on China and Indonesia and Thailand and Vietnam and Malaysia, and on it goes, through Australian spy agencies. Through the NSA, so it's all connected now, and there's nothing that anybody has done or can do in any electronic device that isn't tapped.
Well, it's completely out of control, and I wish we could continue, but we're out of time, so I've got to wrap it up. Oh, it was a wonderful hour, Bob. I look forward to having you back for more. I wish you a good Thanksgiving. By golly, that is coming up. It'll just be just an ordinary weekend for me. But again, Bob, my great thanks. Quickly, I'll remind listeners, tune in on Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time, on weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.